Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome everybody to Health, Wealth, and Divine. My name is Juan.
The
Asante culture, the society, and looking at different factions or aspects, the better term, of their society. And what, I mean, I'm coming away with a lot of information. They had a very, very detailed, succinct, they had a system in place that is extremely powerful when we look at it. And I just love the fact that we can actually glean from that model and see how we can apply those principles today. Again, today we're going to be looking at the environment. So I can't wait to get into this. So the Asante and the environment, that really is a good point of departure. Some people listening for the first time might wonder, well, what is the connection between the people and the environment? So I'm going to let Brother Orwa break it down for us today. So get ready. You're in for a treat. Brother Orwa, the environment and the Asante.
Well, again, we're looking at the focus of the research is on the divine kingship as a means of creating and maintaining a sustainable community. And as part of the community development, we got to look at, we discussed the social, political, and economic aspects and how the kingship sustains those activities. So tonight we'll look at it from the perspective of, well, how does the kingship promote and support a sustainable environment? And basically, the people look to the kingship to preserve, maintain, and enable for the environment to be used to develop and support their lives. Because without the environment, you can't survive on Earth. Everything is linked and tied to the environment. And so the king's responsibility, as with all other things, is to provide an environment for people to understand the importance of the environment, to preserve the environment, so the environment can be used to support the lives of people, not just for this generation, but for generations to come. When we talk about sustainability, we like to refer to the UN definition of sustainability, which was activities that are conducted today which do not threaten the ability of future generations to conduct their activities.
Okay.
So the part of the Asante model, the Divine Kingship model, is linked in, as we've been discussing this, and we've been talking about how this links back to the ancient civilization of Kemet, and the fact that the Asante trace their ancestry back to that civilization, and how in ancient Kemet, there was an understanding of the concept of what we call Ma'at. Ma'at was the spiritual concept that said that everything in the world is interdependent and interrelated, that you can't affect one thing without affecting everything else. So since we all are part of the environment, we all have to live in the environment, we depend on the environment for our very sustenance, then we have to be mindful that anything that we do in one area of the environment is going to have repercussions, either positively or negative, in other areas of the environment. And so in traditional societies, there's always a great importance put on the spirituality and preservation of the environment. So that, and we've been talking over the past several sessions, that it's impossible within the African context to extract and separate what we call spirit from everything else, what we call God from everything else. So it's about that God has these two aspects of being. God has a consciousness, the ability to perceive and evaluate and see things, but also has a spirit, which is the functional part of the divine being. So our spirit is what gives us the ability to operate, to express, to function in the world. Well, the understanding is that what we call the world is a part of the body of the God, of God. And since man was made in the likeness and the image of God, then it is also a part of our body. We also have access to that part of being. And so since everything is spirit, there's only two things, consciousness and spirit, then I'm aligned with the traditional African view of the world as one being of spirit. You know, you hear people when they talk about Africa, the African people believe in all these different spirits. But there's the spirit of the wind, spirit of the water, spirit in the tree, spirit in the antelope, spirit, everything is spirit. Well, that's in line with what today science is now coming back to appreciate and understand. And they try to codify it to this concept that they came up with a few years back called Gaia. It's basically the concept that says the earth is a living organism, a living being. And that everything on the earth is interrelated and interdependent on everything else. And as such, if man is going to survive and man is going to move forward, then we have to work in concert with the environment as opposed to the Western model, which has been put forth through the last 400, 500 years or so, probably extend back another 500 years on top of that, where Western man has begun to perceive and move forward with the idea of conquering the environment, of taming the environment, of subduing the environment. In reality, what he's done is destroy the environment. So much so that we have scientists from all over the world and leaders all over the world in Paris trying to conclude a deal to preserve and protect and maybe sustain or forestall, may predict, as a cataclysmic effect of this climate change that's taking place. And in spite of what Donald Trump may say, it's real.
Well, what would you say when you look back and you think about historically how man, when you look at Western man, quote-unquote, and African man, and just the origins of these two very vastly different groups of people and their concept of God and nature. Because if you look at Africa and then you look at the African climate, okay, it was conducive to, or it is conducive to growing, you know, a lot of greenery, enough to share. You know, you have enough food that you can, you know, give away, you know, just because of the climate, because of the sun. And then when you look at the Caucasoid Mountains, or even, you know, the people that lived in Europe back then, and just because of the climate, because of the cold, because of the harsh weather conditions, it was hard to actually grow anything. So now you're looking at a people whose view of God from the African perspective could be a very benevolent God. From the European perspective, it could be a very angry God, and how that shapes each culture's view of their relationship with this divinity, this divine being. From African perspective, oh, God loves us. You know, God, look at all of this. He's given us, or it's given us food and water and, you know, everything that we need. And from the other perspective, it could be that God hates us. You know, look at the conditions that we're under, and thus that attitude giving rise to the perspective or the mindset that we have to conquer nature, you know, or else it will conquer us, you know, as it had historically. Your thoughts on that?
Well, it has to deal with not man's understanding or the feeling about nature. It's a lack of understanding about what God is.
Mm-hmm.
It's African understood that what you call God is what I am, and that everything is here to serve as a vehicle through which God, my true self, my true consciousness, can experience and express the potential which is innate in my being. And we had this discussion, I think, a few weeks back, where, just to keep it real short, if we believe, if we say that God is an omnipresent reality or an omniscient reality or an omnipotent reality, so if I say God is omniscient, meaning all-knowing in its essential state, well, prior to creation and manifestation, manifestation and creation, I should say. There is nothing that, you know, things are manifestations or organizations or creations out of the spirit of God, what we call Ra. So everything comes out of spirit and is organized, and things become delineated. Things have demarcations and boundaries, so et cetera. You can distinguish this thing from that thing. Well, all of these things, if God is an omniscient reality or an all-knowing reality, then the only way that God can truly experience the true potential of his being is to create all possible things and then know them. And knowing is what? Knowing is an associative process. I know something because I experience it. So the fact that we have this universe that's been created is for no other reason than to provide God with the vehicle through which it can experience and realize its true potential of omniscience.
Mm-hmm.
So if you understand that, then your approach to quote-unquote nature is understanding that everything that, you know, it's like the, what's that thing in The Lion King about the circle of life, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everything is interrelated, interdependent, as we were discussing earlier, the concept of Ma'at. So if I understand that, then I can't come up with the idea of an angry God, because God is who I am. God is my essential nature.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't understand what God is, then you believe that you superimpose your human characteristics on the divinity. You know, people say God made man in his own image. Man makes God in his own image.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I believe that anger is a natural force of being that should be expressed, or jealousy or greed or envy or whatever, then I'm going to assign those human characteristics to my divinity. So if someone says that God is a jealous God, then you understand that they're a human that is superimposing the human characteristics onto the divinity, as opposed to understanding that God, the essence of God, is peace. And that's the only natural response that we should have to anything in our lives. So if I understand that it's all about, there's nothing is against me, then how can nature be against me?
Mm-hmm.
If I understand that the second law of the 11 laws of Mart is that the law of Osir is that nothing or no one is against me.
Mm-hmm.
So anyone who believes that nature is against them doesn't understand the true essence of their being, the divinity. So that's really hits the road. It's the African understood that we are divine beings on earth, growing through the experiences that we interact with the things of this earth toward our divinity. Whereas Western man is under the belief that we're human beings, and depending on who you talk to, how they define this human thing, is either an animal with more intelligence, or some people say this is an animal. I don't know however they define this human being. They understand that that's who they are, and therefore they look at everything from that limited perspective.
Well,
so the idea of nature being against us, and we fight against nature, we got to conquer nature, is a human perspective. Because as a divine perspective, I realize, again, understanding the 11 laws of Ma'at and the law of Ma'at itself, which says that everything is an integral part and interdependent on everything else. So how can I fight against? It's like saying the liver should fight against the kidneys. We should fight against the heart. We should fight against the lungs. No, if my body is going to work well, these things have to work in concert, each of them doing its particular role and responsibility, so the overall body can function optimally.
Mm-hmm. So this whole human persona, or this human, or this belief that we're human, for those who have that belief, for those who have not reached the level of spiritual awareness where they have come into the realization that we are divine beings, the human aspect is an evolutionary process, right? I mean, ultimately, everybody's going to get there. Is that the belief that we're all going to get there? We're all evolving. Some of us, historically, even have realized our divinity and created systems and societies based around that as a fundamental foundation that we're divine in everything from the economics to the spiritual, the political, the social, the everything was built around that premise. But then there are others who have not yet reached that level of spiritual development, but even as they may confess even that they are human beings and flawed and have no problem with that and make excuses for all of the, you know, the things, hey, I'm only human, yeah, I messed up, hey, whatever, I'm only human. That even that is, in itself is an evolutionary stage. Is that correct? That ultimately people will transcend that or get beyond that as we evolve, and ultimately we will all come into our divinity.
That's the design. That's the plan. It is definitely going to take some people a little longer than others.
Okay.
Because the main thing that you have to get to, the main point you have to get to, is understanding that there's something wrong here. If you believe that you're correct, you know, have you chosen one that they don't know what they don't know,
mm-hmm.
which is the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And since we're talking about the environment, then these wrong behaviors will manifest themselves in how they function with the environment, which, again, leads back to problems in the environment. You know, in traditional amongst the Asante, and pretty much through traditional Africa, since we're talking about the Asante, we'll use them as the model, there were protective elements put in place, taboos, et cetera, put in place to preserve and maintain the environment. For example, there are certain days where taboos. Well, let me before I go there, let me just extend this concept a little further.
Okay.
The idea that everything is spirit, which is in line with the scientific understanding today in terms of quantum physics, that energy and matter are all intertwined. Right. So the concept that spirit is energy, is matter, is an ancient idea that many scientists are coming to even today. Now, if I say that, and so the bigger something is, quote unquote, the more spiritual force it will potentially possess. This is just using some general concepts. So that means a lake will have a lot of spiritual force in it. More so, we'll say, to give a reference in terms of radiation. Well, in Africa and in Ghana and Asante, there are the primal bodies, the forest, the bodies of water, the lakes, the rivers, etc., are all said to be possessed by spirits themselves. And as such, people were taught that you have to interact with elements, spiritual energies in certain ways. For example, let's just say that you know people are different, right? So you know, if you know a certain kind of person is kind of reactionary and, you know, flies off the handle a lot, when you address that person, you're going to take one approach, then you'll take with another person that you know normally kind of shirks away from situations and doesn't want to address things, etc. So you get two different types of people, two different spiritual energies functioning through these people, and so you approach them differently. Well, the same concept, to extend the metaphor, can be applied to how people traditionally, African people traditionally, engage with and interact with the environment. And that you learn through experience certain things in the environment need to be addressed in certain ways and protected in certain ways. If you're dependent, let's just break it down. If you're dependent on the environment for your sustenance. If your food comes from that environment, which it does, if your material for development socially and economically comes from that environment, which it does, then you're going to have to look at, well, how do I make sure that my food source is not tampered with or abused or disturbed? How can I make sure that if I'm dependent on having an environment for building my home or whatever, how am I going to make sure that I don't overextend my use of things so that I undermine the ability of my children and my grandchildren to have access to these things? These are the kinds of concepts that were built traditionally into the Asante system. These are the kind of concepts that are built traditionally into the indigenous systems of people all over the world. So within the Asante, though, you would have this concept, they would have these stories, and they have discussions about the spiritual force or power within a certain body. Let's just give an example. I'll give a couple of examples, actually. There's a lake called Lake Bosumtwe in Asante, which is said to be possessed of, I think it's something like 77 spirits or something like that. I forget the exact number. And there were certain days where people were told, cannot go to this lake. You can't go. You can't go there and get a drink of water. Certain days you can't go there. Certain days you can't fish there. Certain days during the week that no one was to disturb this lake. Or you would suffer from a spiritual calamity. Now, most people, you know, take such stories as, you know, wives' tales or whatever. Let's just pull some couple things from the experience. A personal experience, not my personal experience, but a personal experience of a group, a person in our group that we had when we went to Ghana the first time, I think it was. We went to, some people went to swimming to this lake, right? And we're from America. We don't know anything about the customs and traditions and these taboos or whatever. So we go there, and I personally didn't go, but some people went there. And a brother who's a very good swimmer, it's a lake. It's not an ocean. It's not no undercurrents or rip tides and that kind of stuff. It's a lake, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a brother who's a very good swimmer goes out into the lake. And all of a sudden, from his account, he felt like he was being pulled under, right? So much so that he almost drowned. People had to literally pull him out of the lake. Now, they found out after this all took place from local people that was a taboo day. That was the day that no one was supposed to go swimming in the lake. And the story was, the explanation was that the reason he was spared was because of his ignorance. You know, so ignorance of the law can be valid in certain circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
Now, people will write it off as, well, that's just a coincidence or whatever. But there's all kinds of stories that you'll find amongst the Asante, people in general in Africa and Ghana, about these kinds of things. Certain days you don't do this. For example, in another area, this was told by a friend of mine who was helping me with the research, he's a manager of a farm, several farms. And so in one of the areas where they were working, they were they had to call in a bulldozer to clear some area. And so the bulldozer was working, and he didn't finish the job. No, as a matter of fact, he finished the job. And the next day was a taboo day at that farm, in that area. So no one can work on the farm on that day, right? So he wasn't working. He just said, well, you know, I'm finished. So he had to drive the tractor he wanted to leave so he can go to another place to take care of, you know, what he had to do in another place. It's a taboo day. I'm not farming. I'm just going to leave, right? Come in. He had to drive across a riverbed, now the stream bed, but the bed was dry. So he came in over it. It didn't rain or anything while he was there working. So he was just going to turn around and drive back out on this day, which is a taboo day. So he gets into the tractor, and he begins to cross the same stream that he crossed a couple days earlier, and it had not rained, so there was no added moisture or whatever to the situation. And the thing gets stuck. right? So he tries, and several guys come and try. They try to get this thing out. They cannot get this thing out, right? So they go to the chief of the village, and the chief consults with someone, or he comes up with the idea himself that do a sacrifice to the spirit of the of that village or that farm, so that the spirit will allow the tractor to move. So the next the next day, before the sacrifice is done, they try to move the tractor again, and they cannot move it. So do the sacrifice. And literally, almost immediately after the sacrifice is completed, they go back to the tractor, turn the thing on, and they have to drive out of the park. Now, people will say, well, maybe that's coincidence or whatever. But you have these kinds of stories, and stories about certain groves, certain forests, et cetera, where you cannot, no one is allowed to go in there. You can't go in there and take a leaf, or there are certain trees you can't cut down. And if you cut them down, then you may suffer some calamity. And the only way you can cut down these trees or cut these bushes or pick these leaves from these trees is if you do some kind of sacrifice. Now, these kinds of stories we've heard historically, and we all just write them, have written them off as, write them off as juju or whatever, right? That mystical stuff or imaginary stuff or not valid, that these are just primitive man going about his daily life, that this you don't need to worry about cutting down the tree. All you got to do is just cut the tree down. Well, within the context of what's taking place in terms of scientific research, we're beginning to find out some science is beginning to verify and validify many of the concepts and the practices that, quote-unquote, primitive Africans have used as it relates to plants. You know, the idea that a plant can be cause you harm if you don't address it properly, if you don't do an offering to the spirit of that plant before you cut a branch or whatever. I mean, the artisans, the people who do the carvings, people make the drums, etc., they don't just go out and cut stuff down. They do offerings, they do prayer to the spirit of that tree or that tree before they cut it to allow them to take the tree. So it's just, this is reciprocation in terms of spiritual energy that's taking place. I'm giving up something because I want to get something. And we look at it as though the sacrifice is has something meaningful or not meaningful about it. But we don't understand what a sacrifice is. A true, when you sacrifice something, it means you've given up something that's meaningful to you. And you heard the old saying, it's better to give than to receive, meaning that by giving, you get more back. The same is true with a sacrifice. When a person does a sacrifice, they are giving up. And we've got to remember, we're talking about in a traditional community environment where wealth is based on the resources that you have at your disposal. And many oftentimes wealth is tied up in your land and your animals, etc. That people just don't wantonly go out and just kill an animal because animals are valuable. Animals are part of this maintaining the family, having food. And so if I'm going to give up a cow, which may be the equivalent of giving up to a person that is on a fixed income, or maybe working a $50,000 job, maybe giving up like $10,000. That's what a cow could be valued at within that context. That's a significant offering. That's a significant sacrifice that I'm making. So I'm giving this thing up because it's called reciprocity. I'm giving up so that I can receive. So when a man is making the sacrifice, when a traditional artisan is giving up the sacrifice, he has to give up this chicken or whatever it is, that is a value. That's the equivalent of us giving up a significant amount of money to accomplish something. Now,
so do sacrifices have to be conscious? I mean, does a person have to consciously, you know, does it have to be a stated thing mentally? You know, I am sacrificing this to get that, because you have a lot of people who are just givers by nature. I mean, it's just, they're not selfish at all. They just constantly give, 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 but they don't view their giving as giving to get something. They just view it as, oh, I see a need, you know, let me fulfill it. You know, somebody, you know, needs to borrow some money here. You know, don't worry about paying it back. You know, you have people that are just givers like that. I mean, so when it comes to actually receiving the benefit of the, I guess, the sacrifice from the Spirit, does it have to be a stated conscious sacrifice that this is an intended thing? I'm doing this in this particular way for this particular reason.
Well, it's like it's from this perspective. If I have a pair of pants on, and in my right pocket I have $1 million, and I take that $1 million out of my right pocket, and I would try this at home if anybody willingly send me $1 million. I would prove this at home. Anyway, I'll take that $1 million out of my pocket, my right pocket, and put it in my left pocket. Now, from one perspective, it could be looked at, well, the right pocket just lost, and the left pocket just gained. But from the proper perspective, it's understood that, no, I've just shifted some energy around. So if I'm giving up something, if I'm transferring energy from one situation to another, then there's a reciprocity law at stake. And a sacrifice doesn't have to be something tangible, quote unquote. The greatest sacrifice is giving up of something within your own, some deficiency or some emotional or spiritual challenge within your own spirit that you need to overcome. For example, if I can give up selfishness, if I'm a selfish person, right, I'm always looking out for myself, taking stuff from others, always just looking out and making sure that I got something and not concerned about the welfare of others. For me to give that behavior up is going to generate, it's going to release a whole host of spiritual energy that I can then benefit from in terms of this exchange of energy. So that I'm going to get to the point that I was trying to conclude with this concept of the so-called sacrifice. So by giving up this thing, whatever this thing is, then I'm understanding, I'm showing the reciprocity within standing. How one thing has to fuel and give up to get something else. Again, it's back to that law, the law of my art, how things are interdependent. If I'm only taking and taking and taking, then I'm creating an imbalance in nature. I'm creating an imbalance in my spirit. So to get something, I must give up something. And that keeps the wheel of life turning. So everything is about energy exchange. Now, if I don't want to participate in that energy exchange, then, according to the Asante and the taboo that people have these calamities because they didn't observe the taboo days or whatever. Now, let's not say, in terms of science, in terms of the idea that a tree, if I don't offer something up to this tree, that it can hurt me, harm me, spiritually impact me, I need to look at, well, what are they discussing, what are they learning about plants and science today? And so what the latest science is showing that plants have the same senses that we as humans have, but they have other senses as well. And not only that plants have built into their program self-defense mechanisms to protect themselves from invaders or people that would or things that would harm them. For example, they've discovered that there's a tree, called an acacia tree in Africa, that is often the leaves. You know, during the dry season, animals will eat those leaves, like deer or whatever, the low-hanging leaves. Well, they've discovered that if too many of the leaves are being eaten by animals, the tree produces a toxin in the leaf such that animals who eat it, it will kill them. Now, Is that different from the African, the artisan who says that if I don't make to give an offering to this tree, that this tree might harm me? They discovered that there's plants that like that, for example, like beans or corn or whatever, that if a caterpillar is eating on the plant, and too many caterpillars come in and start eating the plants, that the plants send they can do one of two things. They can change the composition, the chemical composition. This is a plant now changing its own chemical composition such that its leaves are less tasty. And two, there's also a process where plants send out a message to wasps that the wasp picks up, kills the caterpillar.
That's
so
interesting.
You know, these ideas that these Africans are primitive people and they're just, they got these superstitions about plants and what could happen with plants, whatever. Science is now validating the basis of many of these ideas. There's a man named Igmewale. Igmewale is a Nigerian. He's the father of the man who's the father of the Internet.
Okay. He's the father of the man who's the Internet.
Say it again?
You say he's the father of the man who's the father of the Internet?
No. He's the father of the Internet.
Okay.
The reason why we have an Internet today is because of this Nigerian named Igmewale. He lives here in the States. Actually, he lives in the D.C. area. He's the one that wrote the code, the algorithms that enable computers to talk to one another.
Hmm.
And he has this whole, if you go to his website, he has this thing on here, on his website, about plants and how he's intuiting that plants, the rainforest rather, can teach us the next level of computing development. So he has this project where he wants to go to the rainforest and study these plants to get to intuit and intuit the ideas on how to develop this next level of computers out there. So there's a lot about plants that, and this we would be remiss if we didn't mention the most phenomenal, well, it's hard to measure what's most phenomenal, but George Washington Carver.
Mm-hmm.
George Washington Carver, as you know, was called the Peanut Man because of the great work that he did in saving the world. Let me emphasize that concept. He saved the world's economy, agricultural economy, starting in the South, but his practices and principles were taken all over the world, how to rotate crops and re-nitrogenize the soil. And Carver, when he started his work, they say that, I think the number is something like there was, when he started at Tuskegee, there was like, southern planters were producing like 4 billion tons of peanuts a year. And 20 years later, after he'd been at Tuskegee, that number had risen like to 40 billion. So it's been 10 times increase. He was the father of what's called chemurgy, which is today called biochemistry. There's a government report that was produced in 2012, which estimated that the value of the bioeconomy is $100 billion. That is all linked directly or indirectly back to the work that Carver did. His
wow.
work was so, he developed, you know, they're doing like trying to develop synthetic out of plants, et cetera, today. Carver did that back in the 30s and 40s. He had a project with Henry Ford. Henry Ford hired Carver to develop a whole bio system for cars. Because Henry Ford could see that, you know, this gasoline thing was going to be a problem. So they were developing fuel and rubber, Carver's work. Unfortunately, he died before he was able to do most of it. But he laid the foundation. Now, all this is important because Carver, you know, he's got all kinds of accolades and awards he's won. Not only was he working for Henry Ford, but Edison also was contracted Carver to do some work. And the man stayed at Tuskegee and never got a, I mean, basically never got a raise. He could have went off and been paid like 10 times his value, 10 times what he was making at Tuskegee by Henry Ford had he chose to do so. He decided he was going to stay there. He's a very humble man.
Mm-hmm.
And he, but the most important thing about the story is how he was able to come up with all these things that nobody else could come up with. I mean, he had a chemistry, a bio, he had a master's in biochemistry, but there was a lot of people with PhDs and all these other Ds that never came up with the ideas and the resources out of these plants that Carver did, with the peanut, the sweet potato, and all the other things that he did. So people would ask him, well, how do you do this? And Pete Carver says he goes out and he talks to the plants. They tell him what they can do for him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't refute
well,
what the man accomplished.
Let me ask
it
you
wasn't
this,
because
then.
Of anything he learned in a book, because nobody had written the book. He had the ability to communicate with plants and to communicate with them to find out and utilize. He went out and talked to him, what can you do for me today? And he said, well, you know, if you use me this way, you can come up with a dye, or you can come up with another substance. So this was a conversation that he had daily. He said he would, every day, he would go out before everyone got up in the morning and just go out into the field and say, what do you have for me today? And he explained that this was God communicating to him through the plants. Through the, and he used the word, this is the fairies that communicate, meaning the spirits that communicate to him. So when we say that the African, quote-unquote, medicine man or the African artisan is, quote-unquote, communicating with the spirits to find out the spirits in the trees or the plants or whatever, this is an old African practice that Carver was able to commercialize, not for his own benefit, because the man, he could have patented like probably 1,000 different things. He only had 3 patents.
Mm-hmm.
He never really went at it for the money.
I guess my question would
about
be
about the spirituality of the process.
It's, but when you look at somebody like Carver and the brother who, you know, the other brother that you mentioned, the Nigerian brother who, you know, without him would there be no internet. You know, and I'm just speaking specifically of Carver because I don't know about the other brother, but when you read Carver and you read his literature, I don't recall ever reading, and just trying to get an understanding here, how he was able to tap into this, because like today, we have practices now where we meditate, you know, you know, we go inside, we're doing all kinds of things to, you know, enhance our connection with the divine intelligence, to, you know, tap into it so that, you know, God, of course, can come through us, can direct us, you know, and we do these techniques, meditation, qigong, and different things to make that connection to that power source so that we can, in fact, get information that we need to live daily successfully and to make the planet better. But you take somebody like Carver, it seems like this was something that was innate within him, but we know that it wasn't just limited to him. And so I guess my question is, why do you think these things or these talents crop up periodically in certain people when you have others, like, for example, today, again, people who are meditating and, you know, doing all kinds of techniques to connect with the divine? And then you take somebody like Carver, who I never read anywhere where he meditated. Not that he didn't, I don't know. But it's not something that he gave a lot of credit to if he did. But he had this connection. And could you speak to that?
Well, the man was in meditation. You know, it's a spirit. It's built to communicate with in the spirit world, which is what he had, to link his mind. Because understand, again, that there's only one consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
We get the illusion that my consciousness is separate from your consciousness because it's in a different body. But once you have the ability to break down that illusionary division, then the minds become one. mm-hmm. which is an African spiritual practice and understanding, which, you know, the ancestors obviously brought it back with him from the ancestral world. And all of us have this ability, but we're just so tuned out from the spirit world, or I guess you'd say tuned in to the physical world, so-called mm-hmm. physical world, and the rat race of this world, et cetera, that it's just shut off within us. But we oftentimes get these moments of inspiration where that, you know, you get that ding moment or the light bulb goes off. That's a time when we're tapping into this universal consciousness in whatever level, to whatever level we're able to do so. So, but the idea that if I go out and, you know, people communicate with their plants. It's well known. People talk to the plants and pray to the plants, and the plants thrive and result with that. So, you know, we all have this understanding. It's about who I am. If I see myself as one with the universe, as Carver did, he saw himself as a vehicle, one of with God, as a vehicle through which God expresses itself, then that's what the result I'm going to get. If I see myself as separate from the universe, separate from God, then that's the result I'm going to get. The spirit will produce whatever we say we want done. You know, that's the power of the spirit. If I see myself as a divine being, hence at one with all things, and interrelated and interdependent and reliant, and et cetera, on all things, then that's what my spirit will create for me, that environment. If I see myself as separate, isolated from, guilt toward whatever, then the spirit will also create that environment. So it has to go back. It all goes back to how you perceive yourself in the world. And Carver was a very spiritual man and saw himself as a vehicle through which God expressed itself.
Everybody, my special guest is Orwa Hehi Metara and Comet, Paramount King of the Washington, D.C. region of the Osara Society. We're talking about the Asante model and the environment and man's relationship and how they saw themselves in relation to the environment. If you'd like to join the conversation and you're listening by phone, just press 1. If you're listening online, the call-in number is 347-324-5727. Again, that's 347-324-5727. You know, this is very, very, very interesting because, again, when we look at the Asante model and other traditional African societies and just the connection that we had with the divine, and then we look at, in comparing today, how scientists today are coming up with and discovering that what they may have thought and viewed as a foolish superstition that the Africans were into, they're coming to find out that there was a method underlying the things that they were doing that they just didn't understand and are just now coming to grips with. But I have a question, and that's concerning the Asante or the West African model versus, or not versus, but sitting side by side with the ancient Kemetic. Because when, you know, you mentioned that the Asante trace their lineage back to ancient Kemet. But when people look at those two cultures, they appear on the surface to be vastly different. I mean, you look at the, you know, ancient Kemetians, and you see pyramids and sphinxes and, you know, the inventors of these sciences, you know, astrology, astronomy, and, you know, mathematics and writing and, you know, all of these things. And we look back and see that, you know, just looking at the pyramids, they're still there. You know, when you look at West Africa today, you know, you see spirituality for sure, but it's a different type. It's just a totally different expression. And when you read about the ancient Kemetians, I mean, you know, it's very clear that in West Africa there's a lot of sacrifices, you know, a lot of offerings. You know, I don't know, maybe you can enlighten me, as far as ancient Kemet, when it came to expressing or rituals to connect them with the divine, or to maintain that connection, or to acknowledge or express that connection with the divine, Were there a lot of offerings and sacrifices with the ancient Chaldeans?
Well, that's a very good question. Let me try to answer that in the 5 minutes we have left. First of all, the reason why Kemet was able to develop and build the civilization to the extent it had built was because it enjoyed a extended period of relative calm in terms of external forces, right? They were able to cultivate agriculture, first of all. That's the primary thing. Because agriculture, once you don't have to search for your food, once you can store food, you don't have to worry about where your next meals come from, then you have the ability to ponder other things. That's what gives you the leisure where you can now sit back and track what the stars are doing. But if you're having to worry about where your next meal is coming from, if you are a hunter-gatherer, for example, and you ate based on what the environment was producing, then you had to move around. So you couldn't build a stone house because you couldn't take that thing with you. When the antelopes traveled 200 miles away, or the strawberry, I'm just using plants out of exaggeration, strawberries are growing right here, but, you know, they die at the period of time. Then you got to go find peaches, and they're 50 miles away. You can't pack up a brick house and take it with you. So you can't build the kind of infrastructure, the kind of societal structures that Kemet built unless you have first a very strong, well-developed agricultural system, which they did. And because of that, they were able to take time to intuit the spiritual essence of life itself. That's what gave them the time to go into the spirit realm and come up and understand and break it down. And, you know, like scientists have broken down the physical, as we talked before, where our ancestors were able to go in and break down the spirit and make all these connections and linkages, et cetera. So, but then, you know, as is what happens when if I got a good thing happening and I'm willing to share with you, but you want, you know, to take it over, then we're going to have a problem. So ultimately, you know, invaders coming from Asia and Europe, et cetera, came in to try to take over Kemet. And after a while, many of the people just got up and split, which meant they migrated to West Africa and, you know, down into Central, Southern Africa, et cetera. Now, you couldn't, at the same thing holds. They couldn't take those pyramids and structures and all that stuff with them. They couldn't take the texts, the books, et cetera, where they had mapped out these stars and, you know, how these things fly and all these things. But they took it as oral history and as built, woven in as parts of their culture. So you have different elements that you see in different parts, different cultures, but you won't see because when they moved into West Africa, then they had to carve out an existence. So they didn't have the fertile land, very productive land, but not the ability to develop the kind of agricultural base that Kemet developed. Plus, there's a lot of conflict and different groups and moving around, et cetera. So, you know, environmental circumstances lend to the kinds of things you can do in your society.
I can see that.
But a lot of the ideas, the principles, the values, the cultural values and principles that the people of Kemet cultivated and developed and used to divinize the citizenry, those kinds of things were taken with the people because you don't have to worry. You can take a whole lot of stuff in your mind that you can't take on your back.
So
we find these values and these spiritual understandings and stuff being in different groups throughout West Africa that link their existence back to ancient Kemet. I mean, the Dogon are a phenomenal group.
Mm-hmm.
And people can just Google Dogon. And, you know, there's all kinds of, I mean, these people preserved the astronomical knowledge
mm-hmm.
of ancient Kemet,
mm-hmm.
right? So, for example, there's a star that the rising of, one of the Kemetic calendars is based on the rising of a star that rose like 4,000 years or so. So calendar, based on the rising of a star, that has a 4,000-year cycle.
Question.
Who sits there and watches a star for 4,000 years to realize that it's come back and repeated itself? Right? If the day took 4,000 years, we would never see the next day.
That's right.
But they were able to not only track it, but to create a calendar system that's based on it, which means you have to watch it like three or four cycles. That's like 12,000 years of observation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so someone is passing on this knowledge from generation to generation to generation to catalog. Now, the Dogon took with them a significant aspect of this astrological knowledge, astronomical knowledge that the people in Kemet developed. And they encoded it into their spiritual culture, their spiritual practices. It's all based on this star, this invisible star called Sirius B, or the pup star, or Potado.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this star, which is invisible, I say it's invisible because you cannot see it. You can't go outside and look up in the sky and see Potado. It's invisible to the naked eye.
Right.
It was discovered in the 1860s or so by a European with a telescope. Now, but the Dogon have within their culture a ceremony that they practice every 60 years, which is based on the rising of this invisible star, which takes a 50-year cycle. And they create these masks every 50 years. Every 60 years, they do the ceremony about the star that rises. And they found the remains of masks dating back into over 1,000 years, like 1,500 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they can't date it any further back because the mask had been, they put the mask in this cave, and then the mask just become dust after a while.
Right.
They carbon dated, the remains they carbon dated went back 1,500 years or so. So that means that 1,400 years before it was discovered, the Dogon knew about it. And not just knew about it, they had specific knowledge about the characteristics of the star. Like the Dogon knew that it took 50 years for the star to orbit.
Mm-hmm.
Scientists with their elliptical telescopes and everything say it takes 49.9 years. So Dogon knew exactly how long it took this thing to orbit. The Dogon
wow.
knew the path of the orbit. It's not if you were to draw, have someone stand there to draw the orbit of one thing around another, you put the thing in the center, right? Let's make a light bulb in the center. And then most people will sit down and try to draw a perfect circle around that light bulb as the orbital path of something that follows it. But that's not
mm-hmm.
the path that the star follows. It follows as an elliptic, similar to like you've seen how comets come, like they come in and they swing back out, that kind of elliptical orbit.
Right.
The same kind of path that this star had around Sirius, Potado, the Sirius B, so-called circles around Sirius, the dog star.
Mm-hmm.
So it had the same orbital path. Now, you can't imagine that that's the path it's going, because the logical mind is going to say, well, it's going to be an exact circle with the star in the middle.
Right.
The Dogon also said, well, a small amount of this star would weigh as much as all the sands on Earth, meaning it's a very dense star. Well,
right.
scientists have discovered that a cubic inch of this star on Earth would weigh like 2 tons. So the Dogon knew it existed. They knew its orbital path. They knew how long it took to orbit. They knew it was a very dense star. Hundreds of years, if not more, well over 1,000 years before it was discovered by a man with a telescope.
Wow.
So there's, you know, the real deal here is that we've lost so much more than we've gained since we've been thrown out of Canada. And we keep losing. The more we engage and become a part of the Western man's world, the more we lose. We lost and we're going to lose. So that's why it's so important, the work that we're doing, as Sarah said, in terms of creating an environment for us to go back and reclaim our true identity of divine beings as God men and God women on earth. The work we're doing in terms of creating the systems in order to allow us to overcome the limitations of humanity that we have to grow through to awaken our divinity is what's going to enable this world to progress. Because if there's no, there's a concept in this, which I might have mentioned a couple of weeks ago, called epigenetics. And epigenetics means that what you see yourself doing or being encodes into the genetic structure of yourself. So if you see yourself as a human being, that information is coded into your genes. So that's all you'll ever be able to become. So if you see yourself as a divine being, that law of epigenetics also says that you will, and your genes will be coded as such. So now whatever that divine being is, whatever it means, is what you will become. So for us, you know, we have to go back and become the divine beings that we are. And we can use our past, references to our past, to show that we've done it. So we don't have to worry about, this is not something that hasn't been done. It's been done. It's been recorded. We've got the systems. We've got the history, historical records. And we got elements, preserved elements, to show the kind of potential and the values and the traits and the characteristics and the norms that we need to incorporate into our lives in order to bring back that aspect of our being, or better said, in order to allow us to become the divine beings that we are.
You know, Brother Orwell, you've said a lot, and there's so much more we could discuss. Somebody, by the way, wants to talk to you. Somebody, the phone just lit up. I want to thank you for your patience. I'm going to come to you right now. I'm going to call the last four digits of your number, 4356. 4356, you're on the air. Orwell, hey, Mentoron coming.
Thank you, Juwanza. This is Renee. I have to, first of all, thank you. And I have to thank your guest. I feel like a whole completely different person just listening to all of this information. And I wanted to say that it validated two things that I experienced this year. First was I read something, and I think it was from some university in Bonn, Germany. And I thought it was just out in left field. But I've learned tonight that it wasn't. And it was saying that lettuce fills you when you bite it in your salad, that there was an actual study done that says that that lettuce felt itself being chewed. And I thought that was something that was absolutely crazy. But I'm hearing now that it might not be as crazy as it sounded when I read it. But the second thing that was the most amazing was somebody sent me a recording of a cricket, a bunch of crickets, where their chirping was recorded, then slowed down at the most slowest it could be, you know, the record it could be slowed down to. And what you heard was absolutely amazing. It was like a choir singing. Was one of the most beautiful sounds I had ever heard. And I started thinking, I said, so this is what the divine hears when we're listening to that meddlesome and noisy chirp. He's hearing a beautiful concerto. And so tonight, as I've listened, I've understood some things completely different, and I just wanted to say that.
Wow, thank you so much for your contribution. That's amazing. I mean, I hear what you're saying, even about the lettuce. Now, this study was in Germany, you said?
Yes, in Bonn, Germany. I think it was a university in Bonn, Germany. And they were talking about the fact that lettuce actually feels pain when you chew it. And I start feeling so bad. I'm like, I can't eat another salad.
Well, that's an extension of some experiments that were done back in the 60s and early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
There's a book called The Secret Life of Plants. Now, Stevie Wonder did an album called The Secret Life of Plants. His inspiration for that album was based on this book. Now, some of the experiments have been discredited because other people haven't been able to replicate. You know, in science, they believe that if you can't replicate the experiment, then it's not valid. But one of the things that was done in the book, one of the experiences that they came up with was that just what the sister's saying, that plants, when you eat them, they feel being eaten. But more so than that, they discovered that if you prayed over the plants before you ate them, they enjoyed being eaten.
Wow.
As opposed to not praying over the plants before you ate them, they might give you indigestion.
It's just amazing. And it even talked about grass being cut.
Yep.
And how there's a chemical that's released that's like a protectant to them, and they're calling for help. And if I, you know, to stop it from coming under attack of the blades. And I said, well, maybe that's why I can't stand fresh cut grass now, because it activates my allergy. Maybe that chemical release is something to, you know, make people avoid doing just that. And it makes you really think that stuff is not just here, but it's here with purpose and intent. It's here with something much greater than what we can see with the naked eye. And so when Carver was talking to his plants, he was doing something that was natural, but it's not natural in everybody, you know, that we have nurtured and made available to us. But, yeah, I was just amazed at the sound of the crickets. That one just floored me. That one was just amazing. And it lended some credence to say, if you don't praise me, the rocks will cry out. I said, "Woo! I wonder what sound the rocks are making." You know,
hey, they might be making a beautiful sound, Queen Renee.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much.
I don't want to share that. I don't want to get too deep into this, but there's a there's a video, but you can't really get it anymore. It's like, it's an old video. It's made back in the early 60s, I think 1960. It's an old video. But what they did in this video was they used an oscilloscope, a video oscilloscope. And they were able to mic out things in the environment, like rocks or statues or whatever, and record the sound that these things are making. Meaning, when you look at a statue that's sitting there, it's just not sitting there. And it's some basic science, right? They tell us in science that everything is made of atoms, right? And atoms are in constant motion. Anything that's in motion is creating a sound, creating vibration. Right. So a statue that's sitting there,
it's vibrating.
Mm-hmm. And as it's vibrating, it's creating sound. And the sound is going to be determined by the shape of the object and what the material is made out of, which leads back into, you're talking about the traditional carvers, right? You'll find that traditional carvers, and this goes back way back to Kemet, that when a person is making we'll just use an example. Let's say a fertility doll, for example.
Mm-hmm.
When a person is carving a fertility doll, you'll find that the fertility doll they carve today is like the one they carved 100 years ago, which is like the one they carved 200 years ago. Why?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that they keep doing the same thing over and over and over? They still have no imagination. Well, it's based on the understanding that the energy that doll is giving off, that structure, that material, that shape, is giving off a particular sound, a particular energy, a particular vibration, which
mm-hmm.
is having a particular effect in the environment. Because everything is constantly giving off energy. We're always interacting and being bombarded with and sharing the energies of everything else. And so some energies are in concert, some are in conflict. So if I know I need an energy, a particular vibration to cause this particular effect in the environment, then I'll produce that same sound. It's like Ella Fitzgerald, right? With that example, with the old commercial where she sang and broke the glass.
Is it live or memory?
There's only a particular note that she hit that breaks the glass. She's singing a whole bunch of notes, but it's a
mm-hmm.
particular note that gives that effect. So everything's giving off a particular sound. Everything's giving off energy. So if I know what I need to accomplish and I know the energy vibrations that I need to accomplish that thing, would I change it?
Wow. Everybody, my special guest is Orwa Hehi Metura in Comet. Queen Renee, thank you so much for your contribution. I appreciate that. Did you have anything else you wanted to add? Okay.
No, I'm just listening now. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you so much. Brother Orwa, this show has been extremely informative. Is there anything that we haven't covered concerning the environment that you wanted to wrap up with?
No, because we're running late in time. We could be here all night talking about this stuff.
That's true. Well, I want to thank you. Thank you so much for being my guest. I have a couple of announcements. The Sarasota D.C. is going to have a Kwanzaa celebration on December the 27th. Just want to give you a heads up real early on that. It's a Kwanzaa celebration, and that's going to be held at 6224 3rd Street, Northwest Washington, starting at 5 p.m., and that's on Sunday, December the 27th. Okay? If you'd like more information about that, the telephone number there is 202-723-5566. Again, that's 202-723-5566. Again, that's going to be a Kwanzaa celebration. I can only imagine how exciting that's going to be, the energy that's going to be there. So I encourage everybody to get out to that. Again, that's going to be at 6224 3rd Street Northwest starting at 5 p.m. And if you've never been over there, you need to get over there, okay? There is a cafe that you got to check out over there, Sinbib Cafe. If you never tasted vegetarian food, you need to get by there, okay? I still taste. They have this sandwich. It's not turkey, but, man, oh, man, I can taste it now. It's awesome, okay? You gotta get by there and taste their food. They've got a boutique on site. They got clothes. They've got books, okay? So you want to definitely make sure, if you've never been by the Sinbib Cafe in Washington, D.C., make sure you get by there. Again, that's 6224 3rd Street Northwest. The Kwanzaa celebration is going to be on December the 27th. That's Sunday, starting at 5 p.m. Also, this Friday, my special guest is going to be Shechem Meta Uneta. We've been doing a series on five element balancing Qigong, and judging from the numbers, you all are really loving that. So we're not finished with that. So tune in this Friday, starting at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. My special guest is going to be Shechem Meta Uneta, and again, we're going to be continuing the series on five element balancing Qigong. Brother Orwa, any parting words for our listeners?
Well, no, I just want to say that we have another week or so of this series to do. However, it's going to have to go on hiatus for a minute.
Okay.
Next week will be the solstice, and those who don't know about the Solstice, you have a show recorded, archived. They can also contact Tawi at 718-469-3199 to get information about the Solstice or online class or whatever. It starts next Monday through next Thursday, and I encourage everyone to, you know, spend those 4 days as much as you can focusing on what you want to be in the coming year in terms of evolving beyond where you are now. Look at the limitations you may have, the problems you may have, and see, begin to see yourself as that divine being we've been talking about, which is able to overcome and evolve beyond the limitations of this human issue that we are confronted with as much as they can for those 4 days. So I'll be doing that next week, and then after that, I'll be going to Ghana and Africa, West Africa for a couple of weeks. So
okay.
We won't be able to continue this until probably, I think that Wednesday is January the 13th.
Okay.
I think that's the date. I should be just getting back into the country. So either that day or the following Wednesday, but we'll communicate and let folks know.
Well, thank you, my brother. Again, I really appreciate your time. I know you're a very busy man, and to be able for you to be gracious enough to share with us this information is very interesting. It's powerful, and I've learned more about the Asante and just traditional Africa and Kemet in the last month or so since we've been doing this show, and I know that my listeners have, our listeners have as well. Also, I want to let, before we go, I want to let everybody know, Sanupa Ra Keparunk was on last night, and we talked about Bazi and parenting last night. That was Tuesday, December the 15th. So if you missed that show, again, that show is archived as well. I want to let everybody know who's tuned in to this show, Health, Wealth, and Divine, that, of course, during the winter solstice, you kind of want to shut down, you know, kind of, you know, turn the TV off and kind of go inside. And I just want to invite you to, again, listen to the archives during that time. I mean, you can get some real spiritual food here. And also I want to recommend the Tawi Blog Talk Radio, okay? If you're tuning into this show but you're not familiar with the Tawi Blog Talk Radio, this T, like Tom, A-U-I, Blog Talk Radio, check it out, okay? That is the radio, the Osiriset Radio Sarasota Radio, okay. You're going to hear Shechem and Shechem on there. You're going to hear Orwahehi Meturan Comet on there and others. So during the winter solstice, you definitely want to feed your spirit with information that's going to help you to realize your divinity, that's going to feed your spirit. So you definitely want to check out, and I'll give it to you again, that's T, like Tom, A-U-I, Blog Talk Radio. And again, to all of the new listeners to Health, Wealth, and Divine, I want to say thank you so much for tuning in. I really appreciate it. Share the information. This is food. If you're enjoying this and it's like a spiritual meal for you, share the food, okay? If you see this on Facebook, just share it. All you got to do is just click share and share it with all of your friends, because we're trying to help make this world a better place, and we can do it one episode at a time, all right? So, Brother Orwa, I want to thank you again, my brother. Again, it's always a pleasure speaking with you. I've learned so much today. Queen Renee, thank you so much for tuning in. I appreciate your contribution tonight, my sister. And until the next time, I'll be in touch with you, Brother Orwa.
Joanza, one more thing. I'd
yes,
like
sir.
To hear that recording that Renee had. I don't know how we can do that.
Okay, Renee? Oh, let me see here. She's still there. It looks like she has gone, but I can get in contact with her.
Okay.
I can get in contact with her. You want the recording about the crickets?
Yeah, man. And some nice music to listen to.
That's true. Okay, hold on one second. Let me see. No, wait a minute. She's still there. Hold on. Let me, let's see here. Let me go here. Let's try this again. Okay. Renee, you still there?
Yes, I am. I was looking for it as we were speaking because my friend sent it to me on Facebook, and I was trying to see if I could find it again, but I know he can if I can't. So I'll get it to you as soon as I find it.
Okay. You're going to send it? You're gonna,
I'm going to send it to you.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll inbox it to you, and then you can forward it on as you need to.
Not a problem. That work for you, Brother Ola?
Okay. No problem.
Okay. Thank you so much,
I mean,
Queen.
James Brown is gone. Michael Jackson's gone. I need some good music now.
That's awesome.
Nothing like crickets. That'll work. That's good. A good meditation music. Okay. Well, thank you so much again, Brother Orwell. I'll be in touch. Thank you for your gracious. Appreciate it.
Wow.
Everybody, my special guest is Orwell Hehi Metoron Common. Thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in. I certainly appreciate it. As I always say, you could be doing something else, but your spirit brought you here. And so, again, I don't take that for granted. I really appreciate you. So until the next time, my name is Jawanza. You're listening to Health, Wealth, and Divine. Don't forget Friday, Shekham Metta Unetta is going to be my special guest. We'll be continuing our series on five-element balancing Qigong. So until the next time, everybody, thank you so much for your time. Ciao.